kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
This is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. This week's show, a fond farewell to 2016, recorded live on Chicago's South Side.
That's right. The University of Chicago's Logan Center for the Arts was the site of our traditional year-end wrap party, a celebration of our favorite moments of the movie year that was. With the help of some very special guests, we shared the scenes that had us laughing, crying, and dancing.
That show just ahead on Film Spotting.
We're recording this the day after the big live show, Josh, so I know we survived it.
We survived it, but I'm a little bit in the post-show crash haze, I guess, this next day afterwards. But yeah, it was so much fun. Big thanks to everyone at WBEZ and the University of Chicago's Logan Center for the Arts. Beautiful place, for helping us put on our 2016 wrap party. Big fun show. We're excited to share it with you.
We are indeed. It was, as you said, a new venue, had a beautiful big screen behind us. So we tried to take advantage of that with a lot of visuals, including a lot of clips. If we were going to talk about a scene in detail, we were able to share that with the audience first. And that seemed to go well. Josh, everyone afterwards seemed to have positive things to say about that.
That screen, bigger than some of the AMC screens in the city that I've been at for press screenings this year.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah, and we had some special guests join us, some usual suspects, Michael Phillips, Tasha Robinson, both so wonderful during the show. But we'll leave some surprises, as well as those guests joined us to share some of their favorite moments, including opening scene and most moving moment of the year. A note to our radio listeners, the entire show lasted just under 2 hours. So for the full experience, you can check out the podcast version of this show at filmspotting.net or wherever you listen to your podcast.
Let the record show my prediction of show runtime was correct.
Yes.
You predicted 138. I went 152. And
yeah.
I think we pretty much almost hit that on the nose, 152.
We came close. I did know better, and yet I tried to make it so by wishing it would be 1 hour and 38 minutes.
Hey, we were under two for the live show experience. I think that was good.
Hey, we had to give the people their money's worth, Josh, and hopefully we did. Let's start the show just the way our live audience experienced it, with the lights going down and the movie screen flickering to life, showcasing the opening scene from one of the best animated films of the year.
Oh, please be warned. If you fidget, if you look away, if you forget any part of what I tell you, even for an instant, then our hero will surely perish.
Wow. We promise you can fidget. We won't die. Go ahead. Loosen up here. So, how's everyone doing? What a crowd. What a crowd. I'm Adam, this is Josh, and thank you for coming to Film Spotting's 2016 Wrap Party Live. Does anyone have a tie I can borrow? Maybe an ascot? I need to be
not
more formal.
I usually only wear one.
You
we have to
lovely.
Do this show. I kind of want to just find out what happens to Kubo.
You know, we could just watch the movie.
Okay. I do really enjoy putting on this show with Adam at the end of the year, putting a cap on the previous year and reliving some of our highlights. I know the Oscars are still ahead, but really, let's just call it a year after tonight. It's going to be so entertaining, you won't even need the Oscars, I promise you. We're going to get to some unique categories. We do things like Most Moving Moment. We're going to hand out the Film Spotting Golden Brick Award, which you have all voted in, I'm sure. And we're going to get things started appropriately with Best Opening Scene. You just saw Kubo and the Two Strings. That is an honorable mention best opening scene for me. I think it is that one shot that hooked me where you see the moon through the wave, where I was like, okay, I'm in for something special. I mean, it was a Leica film, so I've enjoyed all of theirs. I knew it would probably be good. But when I saw that, I knew they were up to something really special. Animation is all about the details, right? And when they put a detail like that in early on, I was all in. Another honorable mention I had from last year for best opening scene was The Witch. And it starts with the central family being banished. I think it's banished, Adam, in their language is how you say it.
The old English, yeah.
Yeah, they were banished from the community. Now, that may not seem to be too bad to get away from these folks. They don't, kind of look like an unfriendly lot. But at the end of this opening, as the family leaves the village, their wagon fades into the indistinct gray of that forest, and you know things are going to get really bad. So those are my honorable mentions, but my pick for best opening scene of 2016, it's obvious. I had to go the obvious route. La La Land, Another Day of Sun. We really tried to get this video to show to you guys and wanted to open the show with that because it's just so wonderful. We thought about restaging it like we Jimmy did. Fallon did for the Golden Globes. Adam recently got a new car. I think he was worried about denting the roof.
Uh-huh.
So we put that aside. What I love about this opening to La La Land is that, you know, this was a brazen enterprise. Some people are kind of shrugging their shoulders at it now, but to do an original movie musical was a brazen enterprise for director Damien Chazelle. And they could have tried to ease you into that fact by maybe sneaking in the music and the dancing slowly. But no, they hit you with it full force right from the beginning. It's confident, and it's a showstopper as show starter, and it was exhilarating. So that's where I went for best opening scene.
All three are great choices, and I was trying to soften the blow behind the scenes by saying that most people in the crowd, I'm guessing, have probably seen that opening scene for La La Land. Am I correct? Round of applause. Okay, so pretty good number. We're not depriving them of anything there. My first honorable mention is from a film that is a Golden Brick finalist here on the show. It's Creesha, from a first-time director, Trey Edward Schultz. Yeah, let's give it some applause. Go for it. And it opens on this, fade in on this really evocative, haunting, haunted image of the actress, Creesha Fairchild, and then we get this extended take as it follows her getting out of her vehicle and walking up to the house to have the Thanksgiving dinner from hell, basically, with the family that she's been estranged from for, I think, at least a decade or so. And the more the camera follows her, the more intense it gets, the more you realize just how disconnected she is from her environment and how anxiety-filled this whole event is for her. And like I said, I think it plays out over about 8 minutes, that whole opening scene. It's remarkable. Another one I strongly considered was from Hell or High Water. The opening of this film, another great extended tracking shot at the beginning. You see the bank teller there getting ready to go to work in the morning, quiet town, not a whole lot going on, one car kind of circling the block, and we have a feeling that something might be up. And eventually we see the people who get out of that car as the camera follows her in, and they follow her into the bank. And what I love about it is just the misdirection of it, the fact that you think with that tracking shot, it just heightens this heist, and you think that you're in one of these typical kind of movie bank robberies, and everything's going to be really precise and go like clockwork, and we're going to see these masters at work. And then we meet Chris Pine and we meet Ben Foster, the brothers who are trying to pull off this heist, and we realize that they are not Robert De Niro in Heat. They really do not know what they're doing at all. And we know everything that we need to know about those characters from those opening couple minutes, despite the fact that they're wearing ski masks. You can see it all in their eyes. So I really did consider that. But at the end of the day, I had to go with a film that did not make my top 10. It just missed it, but certainly was a movie that I considered one of the movies of 2016. And if you heard our top 10 films of 2016 show, you know, I talked about it in terms of setting up the theme I thought was the theme for the year, which is trauma. And the movie is Jeremy Sonnier's Green Room.
Sam. Sam, wake up.
What's wrong?
What'd you do, Tiger?
When did you crash?
Oh, you tell us, ass.
I guess I fell asleep.
Yeah, with the engine running.
Fully charged. Did you kill the battery too?
You hear the radio?
There's a skating rink about 11 miles from here. Big parking lot.
Ice skating or roller skating?
Just says they're open. Why?
Hockey players whoop more ass.
I don't know, dude. I've seen some pretty badass roller skaters.
At 7 a.m.? All right. I'll come with.
So what I love about that is how subtly and effectively it sets up everything we need to know about these characters and the predicament they're later going to find themselves in. It's really a pretty remarkable bit of storytelling. And the fact that it opens, of course, those first couple shots in, and we get that great visual gag of the van in the cornfield, as our producer, our wonderful producer out there, Sam Van Halgren, pointed out to me, it's also a nice little joke where they are trapped at that point in another green room, the green cornfield there. I like that theory. And the phone being charged is going to factor in to this story in a major way later, but their reaction to this. Most of us, if we found ourselves waking up with our vehicle in a cornfield, we might think things went a little crazy. This is just another day for them. This is just their life. This is kind of how desperate they are. They don't have their acts together in any way, and that desperation is what's going to hurt them later. As you see them riding off there on the bike, they're going to siphon gas. And I love that bit that Sonia includes about asking, and that character who asks it ends up being the most industrious of all the characters, the one who says, you know, hockey players are going to be tougher to deal with than roller skaters. All they do throughout the rest of this movie is make those kind of calculations. They have to make calculations on how best to survive based on the information available to them at that time. So it's all there just within an opening minute and a half.
I think they're really discounting roller derby players.
Valid.
In that calculation.
But at 7 in the morning,
That's true.
She's right. So we made our picks, but we had to enlist some guests, and we're going to get to some great guests here throughout the night. And our first one, we decided to reach out to the writer and director of one of last year's Golden Brick finalists to weigh in on the category. You'll hear why we asked him to weigh in on this particular category just in a moment. Those of you who saw this film may find the performance here a little bit extra appetizing. Let's watch it.
Hi, Film Spotting. I'm Joel Petrakis, writer and director of a movie that Adam had picked last year for best opening scene, which is Buzzard. So I'm here now to introduce my favorite opening scene of 2016. I could have went with Rogue One, that's a pretty good opening scene. But the film I ultimately picked did something that no other film this year did, which was make me laugh out loud right from the start. It's got its own universe, its own absurd rules. It's artful and bizarre and disgusting at once. And it premiered at South by Southwest. Oh, did it premiere at South by Southwest? I think it premiered at South by Southwest with my new film, The Alchemist Cookbook. Called The Greasy Strangler. Take a look.
Time to get up, Dad. You sleep all right?
People like milky coffee. Why not put a little grease in your coffee?
No, Dad. That sounds gross.
Why not put a little grease in your Java? Why not try it?
I'm such a gross out, Dad. I think I might barf.
Well, I'm not saying I want to do it. I just wonder why they haven't tried greasy coffee.
Greasy coffee?
Hey, you probably think I'm the Greasy Strangler.
I never said that.
Tell you a secret. I am the Greasy Strangler.
Hey, I call bullshit on that.
Okay. I'm not the Greasy Strangler.
But you're a bullshit artist.
Yeah, I kind of am.
So, as you can see, very specific type of humor, very divisive. I don't expect anyone else to even get it. I feel like this movie was made just for me, and that's why I love it so much. So, thanks for inviting me to do this. I hope you check out the rest of the movie if you haven't. And don't try to eat dinner while you're watching it. It's one of those kind of movies. Thanks, everybody. Let's hang soon. Bye.
No. That looks scarier than The Witch.
I think that video right there is a scene of the year candidate from Joel Petrakis. Yes. God bless him. But on that last line he said there about being made only for him, I heard lots of laughs. I think everyone's going home tonight and renting The Greasy Strangler. It is available on iTunes and other platforms, along with the movie he mentioned, Joel Petrakis' latest film, The Alchemist Cookbook. And the fine Chicago critic Ignati Vishnevetsky wrote in his positive review of that film, "Whatever The Alchemist Cookbook has to express, it expresses through scenes that feel as though someone were dared to do something while a camera rolled. In the near-extinct tradition of the transgressive underground movie." I think that's fitting, kind of like noshing a plate of spaghetti while you pick your favorite opening scene of the year. So,
should we let people in on the joke of that who haven't seen Buzzard? So the reason Joel's downing that plate of spaghetti in that fashion, the main character in Buzzard is Marty, this disaffected loner, and when he runs into some money, he ends up blowing it all at a one-night hotel stand that involves pretty much sitting alone on the bed and eating a plate of spaghetti in that fashion. So,
and we watch it play out in all of its
real
glory.
Time.
All right, that's opening scene. Our next category is funniest moment, and we thought it was only appropriate to bring up the critic who makes the show approximately 470 times funnier every time he comes on, from the Chicago Tribune, Michael Phillips.
I'm not in a funny mood tonight.
Michael has been lending legitimacy to our live shows for years now,
yes,
I would say.
Has.
I didn't realize that you were actually screening Love It or List It here. You should probably focus on the show.
Multitasking, I mean, Michael, come on.
Yeah, okay. All right.
So hopefully you'll lighten up a little bit.
All right,
we get
all right.
To funniest moment.
Okay, it's great. Hey, first of all, can I just say it's great to be Southside with you guys. Okay?
Absolutely. Okay. Another very good film from this year.
Yeah. I had two. I have one runner-up, because in the interest of brevity, unlike these guys.
Fair.
One runner-up. It's not really a comedy, but who here saw Indignation? The scene I'm thinking of, and I'm not really, I'm a very, very hot and cold guy when it comes to Philip Roth and almost every screen adaptation of his stuff, but there's one scene with Tracy Letts, local actor and playwright and kind of like local theater legend, who plays the dean of this college where the Logan Lerman character has come. I think it's Ohio. My memory for details is like, but it basically plays out like a 10 or 12 minute play, and it is the most exquisite form of comic harassment I've ever seen, and it's just a wonderful acting exercise. So if you haven't seen Indignation, whatever you think of Philip Roth, that's one of the best acted scenes I've seen in years. It's just great. But I'd like to show people something else from Whit Stillman's film version of the Jane Austen early novel Love. Not called Love and Friendship, but the film is called Love and Friendship. And the actor who we're going to see here in his first scene, Tom Bennett, plays Sir James, who's this fantastic idiot. This blissfully brainless, Monty Python used to call him upper class twits of the year. It's a marvelous. I'd like to show it if we can, and then we'll talk briefly about it.
So sorry to come like this. I suppose you weren't expecting me.
Sir James, allow me to introduce my sister-in-law, Mrs. Catherine Vernon, and her brother, Mr. Reginald de Courcy.
How do you do?
How do you do?
Kind of you to ask. Excellent. Truly, very well. Thank you. Excuse my hurry in coming, the lack of notice beforehand, etc., etc. Truth is, I forgot to write. Then it was too late. Now I'm here. Took the liberty of a relation, hoping to be one soon. I must say, you look surprised. You were astonished to see me, no? Not? That's how it looked.
Yes, I was astonished, and I still am.
An impressive establishment you have here, sir. My congratulations. Immaculate.
Mr. Courcy is Mrs. Vernon's brother.
Very good.
It's her husband, Charles Vernon, who has Churchill.
Churchill? That's how you say it? Altogether like that? Churchill? Oh, well, that explains a lot. You see, I'd heard Church and Hill, but couldn't find either. All I could see was this big house. Fine name, Churchill.
I mean, what can you say? The guy's on the. If you read the Stillman script, and this will just take like 20 minutes. If you read the script, which is published, the scene is completely efficient and straightforward and elegant, and it was a wonderful match of sensibilities. Stillman, who we know from like Metropolitan and Last Days of Disco and other films, and Jane Austen. There's, for whatever reason, their senses of humor are very nice together. But this scene doesn't read particularly funny. It's just, you know, it introduces a certain type of character. This guy, every single thing he does, every awkward half gesture, everything, it's painfully familiar to me. And but this guy is like, where has this guy been all my comic life? You know, that was the feeling I had. And you know, he's an established actor in England, but it's just wonderful to see him take off like
so
that.
So, question: watching it, do you think you could watch an entire movie with him as the protagonist, or is the comic relief just enough?
I don't know.
No, I think it's just enough.
That's a good question because it's such a choice supporting role, and he's not incidental to the plot. He's important to the plot, increasingly important to the plot. But the lesson here, I think, is this. It's a big performance. It broad in some ways, but it's such great fun to spend time with somebody that kind of serenely happy in his own incompetence. You know, as social. It's different than just sort of playing somebody as a boor or or like the wrong kind of idiot. It kind of reminds me of what. When Laurence Olivier was doing a Shaw play, I think it was Arms and the Man on stage, he was having a hard time figuring out how to do it or where the laughs were, where they shouldn't be. And a friend of his came backstage after a performance, and Olivier was like grousing. And he said, not good tonight. He says, not good any night. I hate it. And the guy says, well, what do you like about that guy? And he says, nothing really. I just think he's kind of a pompous boy. He says, well, there's your problem. You know, you got to find the things to like. And this guy, you know, he has found every single reason for you to just like, he's back.
Yeah.
It's great.
I think it's because of his happiness with himself, despite his idiocy. Like you were saying, I mean, when he makes a blunder, most of us try to move past it, cover it up. He plows right forward. And he just extends it out and doesn't care.
Yeah. And I mean, the funniest, the famous scene from to the degree this film is famous, the most renowned scene in it that he's in it is where he's just expounding over dinner, I think, about the 12 commandments. The 12 commandments. And so he's got the number wrong. And people are kind of gently trying to steer him, you know, toward the biblical, you know, account. And he's like, really? And it's just, the guy is just, he earned his money. You know?
Is that the same one where he's just enthralled with peas?
Peas. He's never seen peas before. Huh? What do you call these? You know? Now and then you get a performance, usually from a Brit, you know, where it's a period performance that just seems so alive and present, but you actually believe it in the context of the setting and the time, all you can do is just treasure it when it comes along.
Well, Love and Friendship was certainly one I considered for this category. It makes me rethink all of Austen's novels as comedies first, when we've been trained by film, largely, I think, to think of them as romances, maybe, or romantic comedies. But seeing this, you know, it makes you think that they should be looked at that way. I didn't go with that for my final pick, and I'll give a few honorable mentions here quickly to begin with for funniest moment. Did anyone catch Pee-wee's Big Holiday on Netflix this year? Okay, good.
I did, Josh.
Good. It kind of... did you really?
I did. I watched it with the family.
I was so hoping you said, yeah, I was home alone one night and I put on Pee-wee's Big Holiday. Now, either way, I'm glad you saw it. So there's this insane moment that is... I wish we could have played it because I could separate the people who would be laughing loudly and the people who would just be confused. Because it's 2 minutes straight, single take of Pee-wee blowing up this balloon and then letting the air out of it. Maybe we'll get to show that in another show. Hail Caesar had a whole host of options for funniest scene of the year. I know we're going to see one in a moment, so I'm just going to briefly mention another one. This is the consultation with the religious leaders that Josh Brolin, who plays the studio fixer, he just wants to know, does the depiction of Christ Jesus cut the mustard? And he can't get these guys to give him a straight answer. This is really one of the best a priest, a rabbi, and a pastor walk into a bar jokes that I've ever heard. My pick, however, is going to come from a movie that I was delighted got a lot of attention on our Top 10 show from Genevieve Kosky, who picked it. It comes from pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping. So we have some fans, I see, of the music mockumentary. This is with Andy Samberg as a Justin Bieber-like pop idol. Those of you who've seen it, sounds like there are a lot of you, you know that the funniest scene of the year is really the one involving a limo window and certain
no question.
Male anatomy, right? Oh, man. We all know that.
And who hasn't been there?
I go nowhere near those windows anymore after seeing that. It's inappropriate to show tonight, not only because my children are here, it's really inappropriate for all of us. So I'm going to move on. I'm not going to show that. Thankfully, that movie is so funny. Let's watch another pop star scene. This time, it comes from this elaborately staged wedding proposal that Samberg's character makes to his girlfriend. It's a proposal that involves fellow musician Seal and, why not, wolves.
Ashley Wednesday. Will you marry me?
Please freaking say yes, girl.
Yes? Yes.
The world's on us!
Okay. Oh, God!
Run!
Jesus, got wild animals.
Dale, come on, hurry! Are you okay?
I'm fine for a second.
Dale! Oh my God, you got him, dude!
Don't worry, I've been in this situation before. How do you think I got these scars?
From wolves?
Now let's get out of here.
I don't know. Sometimes you can't explain it. I do wonder, who was that woman shooting at, though? You assume the wolves, but right. Maybe it could have been Seal.
I like that film, and what I found writing for the Tribune is that you, when you recommend a comedy, you're going to pay for it. and I mean, I got more bitter, unhappy North Shore. blowback,
You know this will air beyond Hyde Park, Michael.
Right. You're not taping this, are you? But they really didn't want. And you know, you try to use code words like raunch and offensive and outlandish and the rest of it, and it just wasn't. It's like they didn't see it. But anyway, there it was.
Well, great minds here. Yes, the pop star limo scene definitely. If we could have played it, it would be up here. But my first honorable mention is Michael's pick. Any scene with Tom Bennett.
Yay.
In Love and Friendship. 12th Commandment, Churchill, you name it. He's just brilliant in every single scene. And watching it again, it occurred to me that there are a lot of idiots who are oblivious because they're really not paying attention. But he's focusing intently on every word that's being said, but processing any bit of it. And that's a real magic trick. Consider that. Also considered The Nice Guys, the 70s era set noir, if you will, with Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe. And this is where we see Ryan Gosling, obviously, in the toilet. And he's had a bad run-in with Russell Crowe before. That's how he ended up with the broken arm. And just watching Ryan Gosling, that physical comedy of juggling the cigarette that falls from his mouth, the broken arm, the newspaper, and then, of course, a gun, and trying to be intimidating, all while the bathroom door won't stay open. It's it's amazing. But my choice is, Josh spoiled it, I'm going back to his beloved Hail Caesar. It features my favorite supporting performance of the year, Alden Ehrenreich. Can't wait to see him as Han Solo. Can't wait to see him in anything else he does at this point. In this film, he plays Hobie Doyle, a singing cowboy in the vein of Roy Rogers. And when we meet him, he's shooting a film, and he's so in his element. Again, it's all physical work, riding the horse, doing tricks. And then he gets cast in a period piece. And they're trying to expand his profile and his stardom a little bit, and he's got to do some speaking, and that's where he gets into some trouble.
All right, let's try this. Your line, just say it as I say it. Say your line exactly as I'm about to, just as I'm about to do.
Sure, okay.
Would that it were so simple.
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 My dear boy, why do you say that? Why do you say twer?
Well, you should say it like I said it.
Yes.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple. Would that it were so simple.
Watch my mouth. Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Keep your head still. Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
I'm trying to say that, Mr. Lawrence.
Lawrence? Hmm?
I thought a minute ago it was Lawrence.
No, we can use Christian names, my good dear boy. Lawrence is fine, just as I call you Hobie.
Okay.
So, would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple. Trippingly.
Would that it were so simple. Trippingly.
No, don't say trippingly. Say the line trippingly.
Would that it were. Would that it were so simple. 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 Would that it were so simple.
Rueful.
Would that it were so simple.
Rueful, simple.
Would that it were.
Soulful, simple.
Would that it were so simple.
You could say soulful. Rueful, soulful. Would that it were so simple.
Would that it. Would that it were so simple.
Why are you doing this?
Would that it were so simple.
Just keep still.
He's just trying so hard, even down to rolling his eyes during the take and later squinting, just like the director is. Of course, there's the great irony of the whole scene being about would that it were so simple, and we see just how difficult it is. But that added verbal gag, too, of the name of the director being Lawrence Lorenz, just to make it even more
confusing. That's when you know he's messing with him, right?
This is a movie, and I think I'll spoil something. We'll see it later very clearly that is definitely having some fun with the homoeroticism of old Hollywood. And I love the frustrated starlet in the background of some of those shots, just waiting for the boys to stop goofing around. You know, it seems so appropriate to this film. But Aaron Reich's acute ear and his timing, it's sublime. And like Tom Bennett, on paper, I just doubt it's that funny. I doubt with 100 other actors trying it, it would be as uproariously funny.
It had to be the audition scene, I'm imagining, right? They had to use this scene to figure out if they're going to go with Aaron
I would
Reich
think, and Ray Fiennes is, you know, you can't...
You know he can do it.
Yeah, and I just love that Ray Fiennes is basically standing in for all British actors everywhere and their opinion about all American actors.
Say it trippingly, of course, he says trippingly. All right, that's funniest moment. Are we ready for the next category?
I think we should do it.
Okay, let's do it. Music moment. Michael loves to write and talk about movie music, so...
And he loves to sing.
He is going to sing his pick. We're going to keep him on stage for this next category. And Michael, the floor is yours.
We've talked about Krisha before. This is a scene where, after she's fallen off the wagon, where the Krisha Fairchild character... who's really just like trying to grit her teeth and get through this very tense family reunion and a very uneasy reunion with her estranged son, played by the director and writer. It uses the Nina Simone version of Just in Time. And a lot of movies really kind of exploit popular songs in similar ways, in that you get a 3 or 4 minute sequence that's really composed visually to kind of accompany the entirety of a song they like, and often it can be very on the nose. You know, I mean, there was some criticism, maybe valid, I think, of a film I really love, Manchester by the Sea, the way it uses the Ella Fitzgerald version of I'm Beginning to See the Light, and it's, you know, if you take the lyric literally and you can't help it, you know, it's like, it's yes, it's on the nose. And that may be the case here, too, because it's used in this fiercely ironic way when Krisha is basically falling apart in the kitchen. And then we'll see a little minute of it here. But this is the Nina Simone Just in Time.
Oh.
Andrews and Dash were tossed. My bridge is over crossed, nowhere to go. Now you're here, and I know where I'm going. No more doubt or fear. Found my way, click, 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 click.
And then it goes on from there. It's, but do you know what I mean when I talk about the way movies work? They work. It's short. It's a shortcut in a way. You know, we take a song we know, or some of us know, and sort of twist the meaning of the lyrics in a way to kind of use it as dramatic counterpoint. I think it's perfect here, though. Much better. I mean, really, kind of the best use of an existing popular song I've seen in a long time. Just because. That version of the song is one of the least comforting, most kind of the, one of the tensest versions. It is not. It is. It's already a very distinctive and kind of unsettling version of mm-hmm. you know what was just a you know kind of a nice easy take it easy number from Bells Are Ringing. You know the musical. So.
Well, it's the sound editing of using that music and coming in right when she pops the bottle, but then also incorporating what I'm assuming is the live. Audience hearing the musical
right.
recording
it's a live version
is
thing, yeah.
applauding her as she comes. You know, it's yeah. just yeah. so it's not only choosing the right song to use, but then how are you going to match it with the action
yeah,
on the screen?
It,
right,
exactly, it could yeah. be seen as potentially making a light moment out of something that really shouldn't be at all. But it's all about her psyche in
right.
that moment,
right.
and then we get that perspective, certainly her point of view, as we go down the hallway and into the kitchen.
Just one last thing: the score, the original score for Krisha is really sharp and. And unsettling in a very different way, and it kind of it's got this sinister undertow to a lot of it. And they, I don't think they got the rights for the Nina Simone version of this song for the soundtrack. But there is a Krisha soundtrack, and it's worth checking out. You just won't hear this.
So a lot of times for this music category, we're choosing moments like that where it's a non-musical film and it has this jolt, this striking use of music. But we had so many. Not traditional musicals, some of those, but just movie musicals of one sort or another this year that my honorable mentions and my pick are really coming from those sorts of pictures. I mean, what do you pick from Moana? So many choices in Moana, right? It's hard to pass up Shiny. I'm a sucker for Jemaine Clement's Bowie riffs, but I did go with Dwayne Johnson on You're Welcome. It's adorable, Adam. What can I say?
It is. I'm not going to argue with you.
So honorable mention there for me, Moana's You're Welcome. One of Netflix's other nice offerings this year was the Jonathan Demme-directed concert documentary Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids. Did anyone take time to see this? Okay. This includes a really wonderful moment during Drink You Away where the camera just drifts off of Timberlake and finds... all the many, 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 many people in his backup band and among his singers and dancers. And it just spends the whole song drifting in and out of them as they enjoy each other's music and company. And that really captures, you know, this communal spirit that's at the heart of this whole concert and the performance that Demi captures. But my pick comes from what is no less than the best movie of the year, the Coen brothers, Hail Caesar. And I don't think you need me to explain why watching Channing Tatum tap dance on a table in a sailor suit is so great. So let's just watch it. There's that brief cutaway where we see the soundstage itself. And I forget, we reviewed this so long ago if we got into this, but each of the musical numbers have a little moment like that where you see off stage and we're reminded, you know, that this is taking place mm-hmm. on this lot in this larger narrative. So I love that scene.
It is a wonderful scene. One of the scenes I considered and one of the musical cues, I guess, comes from Star Trek Beyond, the use of the Beastie Boys' Sabotage at the end of that film. Nice little moment. And I have to give a little bit more love to Green Room, the scene, really, where they go to the club and play the Dead Kennedys song, Nazi Punks, and, well, doesn't end up so well for them in that moment. And then a scene I talked about in detail on our Top 10 of the Year show, part one, Born to Be Blue, the Chet Baker biopic, where we see Ethan Hawke performing the great song My Funny Valentine, and he's really singing to the woman who's helped him heal and recover and become a guy who can hopefully go back out on the road as he's dealing with not only some personal injuries, but a lot of substance abuse issues, and it's just a really haunting performance. But I had to go with a scene from one of the more acclaimed films of the year, and let's see if I can do justice setting it up. The movie is Tony Erdmann. How many people have seen this film? It's opening in Chicago in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, might be next week.
Yeah, so. I think maybe next week. It's finally
coming to
Chicago.
Week after that.
But this whole movie is one awkward, uncomfortable moment after another. And you're still going to get a little bit of that in this scene as well. This is a film that was nominated for the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Michael, did you see it at Cannes?
No, I didn't go to Cannes this year, but okay. I've seen the film, and yeah, I loved it. It was made the top five for me, actually. Yeah.
Very buttoned-up corporate daughter, Ines is her name, and she's paired against her not buttoned-up at all embarrassing father who loves to play practical jokes, and he comes to visit her where she's doing business in Bucharest and decides to partake in his most ambitious practical joke. Yet, he's going to be a corporate life coach, and he dubs himself Tony Erdmann. In this scene, though, he's actually pretending to be the German ambassador at a little get-together at a woman's house who he'd met in a previous scene. And the daughter at this point is trying to do her best to play along. She's actually been introduced as his assistant, Miss Schnuck. And when she finally decides she's had enough, she wants to split, the ambassador decides that maybe they should do a little bit of entertaining for the crowd.
I believe the children are a future. Teach them well and let them go their way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody's searching for a hero. People need someone to look up to. I never found anyone who fulfilled my needs. A lonely place to be. And so I learned to depend on me. I decided long ago never to walk in anyone's shadow. If I fail, if I succeed, at least I live.
I love watching the reluctance, that extended intro and the father urging her to finally start singing and tucking her shirt in and going for it. And so, like I said, there's still all the same awkwardness and discomfort that you get in a lot of scenes in this movie, but it's also the first scene where we finally see this character let go and stop being self-conscious. And she really embraces the music, and that may be the best shot when it cuts to him for a reaction and his eyes sort of say, I can't believe she's actually doing it. But she finally gave into it in that moment. And I love watching her really dig into needs. And, you know, she's doing her best Whitney impression. And she does a pretty good job. I didn't see it in a theater, but I could barely breathe. I thought it was so funny when I watched it. I do think the context, seeing it within the context of a larger film would probably help. But I've talked to people who have seen it with crowds, and they say everybody just loses it when they watch this, when they get to this moment.
Yeah, and it plays out fully. You know, yeah. It's not. This is a genuinely unpredictable film, and I've kind of found myself not wanting to even really talk about whatever happens in the plot, which isn't. It's not a plot dependent film, but it's better to just. I just defy anybody to actually predict where it goes, and it it's sort of unexpectedly touching in weird places, and it's well not that way. Well, there's a couple
there's
scenes.
There's some of that too.
There's a couple scenes. But it's the kind of film that you just cringe at the thought of the English language remake. You know,
I mean, which is supposedly coming.
It's just coming. So I'm cringing.
Well, I think this scene could have been funniest scene, as you talked about, Adam. It could have been most moving moment too. I mean, mm-hmm. While I'm watching him watch her, I'm thinking they've done this a number of times before, and probably something they did when she was a kid, right? And this is a movie. I mean, talk about the American remake. We'll get a flashback to her as a kid with him, and you know, it'll be explained to us, so we get it. And here, it's just, at least I got the suggestion that this was something they used to do together, and it's ridiculous, but meant something to them. And
maybe
that way it's a most moving moment because it marks a transition in their relationship throughout the movie.
For sure. Michael Phillips, you were wonderful as always. Thanks so much for
joining
us.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Before we get back into the second half of our 2016 Wrap Party Live, we did want to share a quick note for our Chicago area listeners about some advanced screening passes, free movie passes.
We've got passes for a January 23rd screening of Gold, starring Matthew McConaughey. Gold's about a search for the precious metal in the Indonesian jungle. It opens wide on the 27th. It's directed by Stephen Gagan of Syriana, and yeah, this is the first I'd heard of it.
It is the first I've heard of it, and I think it's the first film he's directed since Syriana, which was a really interesting film. I know he's been active with some other things, but I feel like this is his first feature film since then, and that was a while ago. I'm curious about Gold.
Don't you get email alerts every time McConaughey does something like this?
I should. I really should at this point. Also, we wanted to share with you the opportunity to get passes to see I Am Not Your Negro. This has already opened to positive reviews and acclaim in New York and L.A. It's going to open in Chicago on Friday, February 3rd. It's based on the final unfinished book by James Baldwin, and it's narrated by Samuel L. Jackson. And we're actually going to give away Admit 2 passes to see it during its run of engagement here in Chicago. It's playing at the AMC River East. You can enter to win passes to see both of those films at filmspotting.net. It's right there in the top stories. And with that, we get back to Hyde Park and more of the 2016 Wrap Party.
Well, speaking of performances, I don't know if we're going to top last year's Massacre Theater, but it's time for this year's Massacre Theater.
She'll be back at the curtain singing, and I'll be out in front doing, like, in the picture.
That's right.
What?
You've got to do it, Kathy. This thing is too big.
Of course she's got to do it. She's got a 5-year contract with me. Get over to that microphone, Zeldin.
You heard of Kathy. Now do it.
I'll do it, Don. I'll do it, but I never want to see you again, on or off the screen.
So Massacre Theater, this is where we perform a scene from a movie really badly, and you get a chance...
Speak for yourself.
...at winning a prize. We will see how this plays out, and we thought what better way to pay tribute to the passing of Debbie Reynolds than to show just how hard it is to be effortless when you're performing. And we know we need some help. We've managed to cast pick a scene with a pretty large cast. We're going to go to the crowd, as we like to do, but before we do that, we've decided we really need a pro. We need someone who was once named the Paul Newman acting winner at his beloved Kenyon College. Sam Van Halgren, producer of Film Spotting. Get up here. There it is. Were you enjoying watching me shuffle through the pages?
I should have let you squirm.
I came up with a backup plan, okay?
Improv.
Indeed. So, we have Sam Van Halgren up here, of course, producer of Film Spotting, original co-host, and we decided, instead of just randomly picking someone, Sam, as usual, had a great idea. We actually need two people for this scene, and we were thinking, why not bring up two people who we know traveled an incredibly long distance to get here? Let's really make their night embarrassing. Do we have Kenny Meyer out there? Kenny and Jamie.
Right here in
Come
the front.
Up.
Perfect.
Let's go. Come on up. That's your mic.
Hi.
Don't look so excited.
Are you just a little bit in shock?
Just a little bit, yeah.
So, Kenny, just tell the crowd a little bit where you guys came from and your background with the show. You've been listening a long time.
Okay, I have. I've been listening for about 7 years, and...
my sister Jamie here came on board about 4 or 5 years ago. We're from the Palm Springs area in California. I now live in Boulder, Colorado. And yeah. And I think a couple of years ago, I just joked that one of these years I'm going to make it out to the Film Spotting live show. And she made it happen, so we're here.
Another moving moment. Are you mad at me, Kenny?
No, okay, quite the opposite.
Good, good. You actually start off this scene. So I guess I'm going to give you the action. Are you prepared? Have you looked over your side?
Yeah. Well, we have other players in this scene as well.
Oh,
I mean, this
you.
Seems like I enough. Forgot. I know, but why not involve everyone else?
Yes, we do need everyone else. So there is a line coming later in the scene where Josh is going to say, "Okay, fair fight." And when he says "fair fight," the crowd has to say, "No, you're not happy with that choice." So let's
do a rehearsal.
All Josh right? is going to do his line. And
okay.
You guys are going to respond.
Fair fight.
No!
Wow.
Yeah.
Pros.
Definitely the best actors here. Okay, so, Kenny, in looking at this, do you have any idea what scene we're about to massacre?
Don't say it, please.
I don't. I'm totally stumped.
All right, that will only help the process.
It will. We're not going
to
give...
I'm trying to come up with a character, but I got nothing.
Okay, well, that's...
You can go any direction you want.
That's right. You really can.
Oh, and Josh Larson's lead.
We're not going to give you any hints either, but I will say this. Yeah, maybe this is a hint. Sam actually came in character. He's dressed like his character tonight. That's how he does it. That's how you win acting awards in college. So,
something's coming, Adam. Something's coming. That's all I'm saying. I can't wait.
Okay. Are we ready?
Let's do it.
Okay. And action.
Weapons.
Weapons!
Weapons.
You call.
Your challenge.
Afraid to call?
Rocks.
Belts.
Pipes.
Cans.
Bricks.
Bats.
Clubs.
Chains.
Bottles, knives, guns. What a coop full of chickens.
Who you calling chicken?
Every dog knows his own.
I'm calling you all chicken. Big tough buddy boys, gotta throw bricks, huh? Afraid to get in close? Afraid to slug it out? Afraid to use plain skin?
Not even garbage?
That ain't a rumble.
Who says?
You said call weapons.
A rumble can be clinched by a fair fight. If you've got the guts to risk that, best man from each gang to slug it out.
I would enjoy to risk that. Okay, fair fight.
No!
Wait a minute. The commanders say yes or no. Fair fight.
And scene.
Wow.
Oh.
Well done. Some magical stuff. Thank you, Kenny. Thank you, Jamie. I almost told you out in the cafe earlier. I almost prepared you for this, but...
Oh, they didn't know?
No, they didn't know.
What?
Oh, no.
I'm sorry,
I
guys.
I wanted the shot.
I thought this was all agreed upon.
I'm a director. I'm going for a certain reaction. And hopefully we got it. If you know what film we just massacred, and I kind of don't know how you wouldn't, please email the title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is January 30th.
The winners will be chosen randomly from all the entries and announced in a few weeks. For official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net. And despite how it sounded, here's another clue. I wasn't playing a vampire. So set that aside.
A little Count Chocula.
Set that aside.
Sort of going for it there at the
end.
And
you'll be better off.
Okay. Let's move on. We've had enough fun. Let's finally get to the actual most moving moments of the year. And we thought, to start us off, we would go ahead and get to two of the most prolific, I think fair to say, prolific podcasters around. And, you know, I was going to say maybe to be wary of just the slightest bit of spoilers with this, but I really don't think there is. Just if you hear the movie title and somehow you haven't seen it and you're really, really, really sensitive, I suppose you can close your eyes and plug your ears if you want, but... Let's let him take it away.
Hello, everyone. It's your second favorite podcasters after Film Spotting, David Chen and Joanna Robinson. You may know us from shows such as A Storm of Spoilers, The Slash Filmcast, as well as A Cast of Kings, and our newest podcast, Gen Pop, which you can find at genpopshow.com.
We had a pretty difficult task for our friends at Film Spotting, who wanted us to pick our most moving, emotionally impactful moment from a film in 2016. We had a few runners-up that we wanted to mention before we get to the most devastating moment. That would be number one for me, Casey Affleck's confession at the center of Manchester by the Sea, which made a lot of grown men around me openly weep. Number two would be the ending of Star Trek Beyond, where Chris Pine's Captain Kirk raises a toast to absent friends, and the camera cuts to Anton Yelchin, who passed away in 2016. So those were a couple of mine runner-up. Dave, what did you pick?
Great choices. Very powerful moments there, Joanna. For me, a couple of moving moments I really enjoyed from movies in 2016 were the final sequence on Scarif in Rogue One. Very beautiful, powerful moment, very well done, and a moment that I actually didn't see coming at the end of a big-budget tentpole blockbuster. Also, the ending of La La Land in Seb's Club, very powerful, a moment that was such a great combination of music and choreography and editing that I felt was actually better than the film that it was in. None of those were actually the final most moving moment we chose, Joanna.
Right. We landed on a film that's at the top of a lot of critics' lists this year, which is Moonlight, the film by Barry Jenkins, which tells the story in three parts of a young man named Chiron, who lives in Florida, is young, black, and gay in a place where it's really hard to be those things. And it's really it's tricky for us to pick which section of Chiron's life is the most emotionally devastating, because that whole movie is kind of like gut-wrenching. But I would say we landed on the final interaction between Chiron and his childhood friend Kevin when they meet up after a long time. They go to Kevin's apartment, and we see Chiron be sort of more open and vulnerable than we've seen him in basically his entire life. And it's a lot. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, why don't we watch that clip right now?
Who is you, man?
Who, me?
Yeah, nigga, you. Sandman in front. That car. Who is you, Chiron?
I'm me, man. I ain't trying to be nothing else.
Oh, okay, so you hard now.
I ain't say that.
Well, then what? Hey, I ain't trying to hem you up, man. It's just, I ain't seen you in a minute, and it's not what I expected.
Well, what did you expect?
Remember the last time I saw you?
For a long time, I tried not to remember. I tried to forget all those times.
It's the vulnerability that we see from Chiron and the warmth that we see from Kevin, and just see these characters who have gone through so much, who have been separated for so long, coming together and really being able, at least for Chiron, really being able to be himself for the first time maybe ever in his life. It's just really, really a lot.
Yeah, I think for me, the reason it really hits me very hard is because you've been with this character through these formative stages of his life. And there is so much tragedy and history between these two characters. There's a great catharsis in the scene. You know, it feels like a lot of things that have been stored way far below the surface are finally coming out in a way that both people can process them and have an honest connection over. For those reasons, this is our most moving moment in a film in 2016. We hope you enjoyed it as well. And thanks for watching. Thanks to Film Spotting for inviting us to join them for this. And find our newest show, Gen Pop, at genpopshow.com.
Yeah, you really probably could have found a most moving moment from each of those sections in Moonlight from his different age periods. My honorable mentions for most moving moment. Who else was nicely surprised by Pete's Dragon this year? Yeah, it's sort of a sweet, mellow 70s throwback, and it included this wonderful moment that I think of as the triple hug scene. So this is after there's been this climactic bridge collapse, and we think two major characters have fallen into this ravine. Elliot the dragon comes swooping out with them on his back, and he lands. They hop off. They each go running to a different loved one who was waiting to see if they survived, and then at the same time, Pete goes running up to give Elliot a hug, all in the same frame. So very huggy, Pete's Dragon, very huggy movie. My other honorable mention is from Moonlight, and it was actually a scene of the year candidate for me. This is when Juan gives Little swimming lessons. Like a lot of that movie, this was a moment that took characters who might have been stock characters on the surface. We think we know characters like this, but just cast them in a completely different hue. My pick, though, for most moving moment comes from another one of my top 10 films, and it's the documentary Camera Person. Now, this one might be a little difficult to appreciate out of context, but in a sense, Camera Person is, it's almost all out of context because this is the film that was compiled from extraneous footage that the director, Kirsten Johnson, had collected over her 25-year career. The beauty of the movie, though, is how that footage begins to coalesce as the film comes together. And for me, that happened most movingly near the end when we return to sequences of this boxer. Now, the last time we saw him at the beginning of the film, he was confidently heading into the ring, full of bravado. Here, later at the film, after all sorts of places around the world with different people we've been, we return to him after the fight scene, or after the fight, and we find that it didn't go too well.
No, I'm going to call you. That was my fight. You don't know nothing! Don't touch me! Don't f- touch me! This fight ain't on. What? I'm going to talk to my mother. What? That's bullshit. I worked f- hard.
Yeah, I know. You,
I was f- him up.
I've been in those positions, buddy.
Been in that position. How the f*** are you going to rob me like that?
Don't get mad. There's a lot of people watching. Control yourself. Let's go in the back.
So that one, you know, like I said, maybe a little difficult to appreciate out of context, but there is this motherhood thread that runs throughout Camera Person. And for me, it just culminates right there for a real gut punch.
Well, and one of the things we talked about on our end of the year show was just her camera and how she really, she does what a camera person should. She never stops shooting. And the fact that she follows him through all that.
Yeah, when he comes out of the shower and
she doesn't
flinch.
As angry as he is
and
the way he looks back a couple times, and you don't know, and I can't imagine she knew whether or not he was looking at her. Is she really still following me or looking at someone else in the hallway? But she keeps shooting. And it might be a case where she feels comfortable. Maybe she's been around that boxer enough that she knows what he's capable of. Great scene, and certainly the Moonlight scenes, you're right. I mean, not only moving moment candidates, but scene of the year candidates, the swimming scene and the ending that Dave and Joanna talked about. But Camera Person was another one for me. It was a different scene that I really gave a lot of consideration to, and it's the moment where we see a woman, and this is all we ever see. It's an anonymous teenager in an abortion clinic in Huntsville, Alabama. And we only hear voices. We assume one is Kirsten Johnson, the camera person, maybe the director of the film. And she's talking, and she just breaks your heart because she's talking about how she's beating herself up so badly. She can't believe that she's got herself into this situation. She's already raising one child, and she's doing everything she can. She's working a job, a full-time job. She's going to school, and she just can't believe that. It happened to her, that this happened, and she sees it as letting it happen to her. And the women on the other side of the camera say that she shouldn't feel this guilty, and they're trying to reassure her, and it devastated me. Another scene that devastated me came from The Witness, a film that I've been talking about a lot on the show this year. It's about the infamous Kitty Genovese murder case in New York in the 60s, and the brother who we see here in the scene, Bill, who was young when his sister was murdered, and trying to kind of put the pieces together and figure out what really happened to her and whether or not 30-some people really did just ignore her in New York City as she was murdered. He tries to actually experience it, and he stages a reenactment in the neighborhood, hires an actress. They let the neighborhood know that it's going to play out, but hires an actress. And something about actually going through it does seem to provide some closure to him. And I talked to the director, James Solomon, on the show this year, and I told him I had to, when it was over, I had to stop the scene and just walk around my kitchen for a little while. It just unnerved me that much. I also gave a lot of thought to Midnight Special. Jeff Nichols, a favorite here on Film Spotting. I think Michael Shannon gives one of the best performances of the year in this movie.
And I don't even know that I can begin to get into the plot of this film. I'll just say that this scene in a field is really good and one I thought about, but actually there's a scene near the end between father and son that definitely moved me. All that said, I had to go with my number one choice for moving moment, a scene from a film that I named as my number one film of 2016. It's Keith Maitland's Tower. This is a film that is a minute-by-minute account, essentially, of the day in 1966 that a sniper went up to the top of the tower at the University of Texas campus and opened fire. The film uses animation and archival footage and interviews to construct this and really make us experience the whole unsettling event in real time. And the scene I'm going to play happens fairly late in the film when we see some of the victims from that day reunite.
It was just a whole different world. Nobody ever talked about it.
I didn't meet Claire until a few months ago.
I never knew who Artley was. I finally decided maybe he was just an angel or something.
I was 17. I'd never seen death. I didn't know anything about guns. It was nothing but a big, raw, gaping wound, you know, in my psyche, in my memory. There's been a passage of time, and it's still raw, but it's not as raw as it once was. A lot of times, the worst days of your lives are personal and private. Maybe that's why I sort of hit it inside. I feel guilty because I didn't go out soon enough.
Oh, Artley.
You know that you were.
Artley.
Yes. So I think guilt comes with events like this.
Exactly.
Strange guilt.
It's powerful stuff, and I've been so excited, and it's been so rewarding. I've been talking up this film for a month or so now, and people are finally now being able to see it, because I think it was just last week it became available on iTunes and other streaming platforms, and we've been getting a lot of emails from people who are having a similar reaction as me.
Was that scene one of the first times where we see them as they look today, where previously the interviews had been the rotoscoping animation, but of them as younger as they were at that time?
It is, and I will admit that I consider not playing the scene just because I think that is a little bit of a surprise, and it's a powerful moment in its own right when we finally go from seeing rotoscoped actors.
I think
playing
that's
these people to actually seeing the victims on that day. But it was just so
huge part of why it's moving. Yeah, to see their faces.
The moment is, you know, when he talks about, when she talks about, nobody ever talked about it, and then he talks about the personal nature of these traumatic moments in your life. There was nothing personal, right, about this spectacle that played out. So many people, so many victims. And yet, for each individual, it was a personal, private moment. And this film ends up showing us the power of art to be this catalyst for expression, this catalyst for healing. And the real moment, of course, is when he admits that he's felt guilt for not getting out there earlier. And when he gets choked up and when she reassures him, that's really the moment that does it for me. It just crushes me. And this film is, I think it's an amazing technical achievement, but it's the really human emotional moments like that scene that really elevate this into one of the best films of the year, and for me, the best film of the year. And as I said, finally available now on a lot of platforms and also airing on PBS in a couple weeks. I think Valentine's weekend, actually, it's playing on PBS on Independent Lens. So if you want to watch it that way, you have that option as well. Believe it or not, we're nearing the home stretch. We only have one category left, our scene of the year, but a little bit of business to take care of before we get there. And I think it's fitting that we're going to transition from moving moment into the announcement of our Golden Brick winner for this year, because you just heard us actually talk about scenes from four of our five Golden Brick finalists, three just in that last category. So we're going to do that here. But if you've attended one of these rap parties in the past, you know that we love to bring Abraham Levitan up on stage, and he's so great and so talented, and he performs these improv'd numbers where he takes the inane things that we say and turns them into wonderful humorous songs.
And we wanted him to be here.
We wanted him to be here. He wanted to be here. He couldn't make it. We figured out a way to include him via the magic of mobile device.
It's the Golden Brick Award. Put on your helmet and your sword. Bow down to the lords of independent cinema. It's the Golden Brick Award. I hope you have your helmet and your sword. I hope you've bowed down to your lord. Salvation for the sin in ya.
Now, if La La Land had had that, I mean, that would have put it over the top.
Absolutely. So you want to share a little bit of the criteria for maybe the uninformed out there?
Most listeners probably know what we mean when we're talking about a Golden Brick eligible film. Generally, it's one that's been underseen. Maybe a handful of critics are talking about it, but audiences have not really had a chance to see it. So that's one qualification. Emerging filmmaker is something we look for, too. Not necessarily their first film, but second or maybe third in some cases, but an emerging name, and then a distinct vision. So as you can already see from Tower, that there's something aesthetically that really jumps out at you.
Yeah, and before you list the five finalists, I will point out that we ultimately settled on a winner by putting together, I think just for the second year in a row, instead of just the two of us hashing this out, we put together a blue ribbon panel of film critics. Michael Phillips involved, Sam, of course, and all our friends from the Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU, and also some guests from Film Spotting this year, some of them who were first-time guests on the show, including Odie Henderson, Alan Scherstel, Odie from RogerEbert.com, Alan Scherstel, the editor of film for The Village Voice, Melissa Taminga, who co-hosted a show with me this year from Seattle Screen Scene. They all weighed in. And, of course, listeners as well had a say in this via the poll at filmspotting.net. So we tabulated all those votes, and we settled on a winner, which we'll hear in a moment.
Yeah, let's first take a look at those five finalists quickly here. The first one is camera person. Kirsten Johnson's aforementioned documentary, compiled from 25 years of extraneous footage from her career, takes us across the globe and into the human heart. The next one is The Fitz, in which director Anna Rose Homer and star royalty Hightower lend a transcendental touch to an 11-year-old girl's days at a local rec center. Also happens to be my number two film of 2016. Our third nominee is Krisha, Trey Edward Schultz's bold, unblinking collaboration with Krisha Fairchild, who plays an estranged, recovering addict who comes home for Thanksgiving dinner. Next, we have Tower, Adam's number one film of 2016. This is Keith Maitland's gripping eyewitness revisiting of the 1966 University of Texas mass shooting. And our fifth nominee, final nominee, is The Witness. This is another documentary from director James Solomon, re-examining the Kitty Genovese murder case from her brother's perspective. I was just talking with listener Joshua David about The Witness today on Letterboxd. He described it as Bill's search, leading him to learn about small acts of heroism and kindness, and also to discover that his sister, or to rediscover his sister, as a complete, complicated woman. So, from those five nominees...
Well, before we do that, I'm just curious by... show of applause here. How many people saw, let's say, at least three of those films this year?
Nice.
Okay, not bad.
Yeah, that's great.
But in the case, as I mentioned, of Tower, The Witness just showed up on Netflix streaming in the past month or so. Some of these films, Camera Person, not available, now available. So as we sit here, if any of these movies sound compelling to you, if you've seen the scenes and want to seek them out, all five of them are on iTunes, Google Play, and Amazon. So you have no excuse now other than time to catch up with these five finalists. And we might direct you, I guess, to the one to start with here with our winner.
That winner is The Fitz. No complaint from me. And we actually have a message from the film's director, Anna Rose Homer, who sent this in to accept the award.
Hi, my name is Anna, and I'm the director of The Fitz. I'm so pumped that the Film Spotting podcast is honoring our film with the annual Golden Brick Award. It means the world to us, really. Thank you, Josh, Adam, the entire Film Spotting team, WBEZ Chicago, just for highlighting our film and championing it throughout the year. Honestly, just being included in the podcast has had a huge impact on getting eyes on the film, and for that, we're truly grateful. Thank you to the audience, everyone who voted. You are the ones who are giving this film life. enjoy the rest of the Rap Party live show. Thanks.
Thank you, Anna, for submitting that. Someday we'll get to actually hand out a golden brick. We're working on that. But didn't I call this about 6 months ago? Don't you remember that conversation in the studio where I said, I think the Fitz...
That the Fitz would win?
Yeah.
Well, I think
you were incredulous, as you usually are when I speak, but look...
I was happy that you made that call.
Okay.
Maybe I didn't want to jinx it.
Well, not only did it win the golden brick based on our voting, but it was the listener's choice as well. Sometimes they do differ. In this case, we were all on the same page going with the Fitz, and you haven't seen any of the Fitz yet, and we are about to remedy that as we get to our final category, Scene of the Year.
My Scene of the Year, it does come from the Fitz. Let's first take a look at it, and then I'll share a little bit more about it.
That smile right before she goes into the last bit of the routine, that, I mean, I got goosebumps watching
that
again. It's been a while.
It's wonderful. I mean, the Fitz is a transformation story. We can all say that about it. And that transformation means different things to different people who I've talked to who have seen the film. And I love that malleability that the movie has. But it's definitely a transformation for this main character, this 11-year-old tomboy who joins an all-girl competitive dance squad. And this is its transformation scene right here. It's captured with music. It's captured with camera work. It's captured with the performance. This really a performance of physicality that Royal T. Hightower gives. Not a word is uttered, right? And you don't need a single word in this scene. You understand everything that is happening to Tony and how she feels from what Anna Rose Homer and the rest of the filmmakers give us here. So I knew something special was happening. I remember the first time I watched The Fitz, and the scene actually begins off the bridge, down the stairs. It's still an unbroken single take. And something about it, I just knew something was happening, right? Yeah. And the camera doesn't leave, mm-hmm. and it follows her up onto that bridge. It wowed me then, and every time I watch it, it still gets me.
Yeah, watching that moment for any person in real life or on screen when something clicks the way it does for her. And up to that point, I love it too that actually it combines the physicality of boxing, which she's good
totally.
At, and the dancing, which up to this point she hasn't been so good at. She's trying something that isn't coming naturally to her, and we've seen her struggle and struggle and struggle and maybe just put little pieces together, and then it does click on the bridge, and it's wondrous.
So I'll throw out a couple of honorable mentions here quickly before we get on to other awards. One of them comes from the Thai film Cemetery of Splendor. This was another top 10 lister for me. And a central visual motif are these glowing breathing machines that stand by the beds of the hospital patients. They sort of function in a lot of ways like the monolith in 2001, A Space Odyssey. They're these emblems of metaphysical mystery. Really, any scene involving them could have been my Scene of the Year. And then one more honorable mention comes from the Neon Demon. This is what I've referred to on the show as the Narcissus sequence. Don't watch this scene. In fact, don't watch any of the Neon Demon if you're sensitive to strobe lights. I'll just warn you there.
Multiple times had to just look away for about 2 minutes during this film because my eyes couldn't take it. And I like the movie, but it's that overwhelming. And that's a good experience at the cinema, too, every once in a while to
Absolutely.
Be that overwhelmed. All right, we're going to get a little bit of help here with this final category, Scene of the Year. She is always fantastic when she appears on Film Spotting and on the Next Picture Show and over at TheVerge.com. Tasha Robinson, please come to the stage.
Thanks for joining us, Tasha.
Thanks, as always, for having me.
So I can't wait to hear what you're going to tell us. I know you've got a surprising honorable mention. Do you have any others you want to get to before that one?
There are so many. When I was looking for the scene of 2016, I kept looking at scenes that felt like 2016 felt for me, that had something to say about how we live. And like, there's a scene in The Fitz where one of the protagonist's classmates suffers from The Fitz. She's having what looks like an epileptic seizure. And all her classmates gather around, and they're filming it on their phones. And because of the way it's staged, you don't actually see her. You just see it filtered through the phones. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, can you think of a more 2016 moment?
Right.
And you can't see what's in the world. You can only see how it's filtered through people's machines. There's a scene in Moonlight towards the end of the second segment where Chevron has a final encounter with his bully. And that seemed to say so much to me about how we operate when tension builds up to a breaking point. The brunch scene in Tony Erdman, mm-hmm. I love so much for what it says about how you can be around people like most of your life and not really know them until you challenge them. And then things get strange, but illuminating. The final scene of La La Land, I think, just said so much to me about how we build these fantasies and operate through them. But as Adam knows, I had a really hard time picking between two scenes for the actual finalist. And the one that I did not go with is a scene from Trolls, the DreamWorks animated film.
Okay.
Trolls, that tells us how we all live today, right? We're all basically like little colorful-haired creatures running around naked in the bush. There is a song in Trolls where Anna Kendrick's character is out on her own for the first time, and she sings this jazzy little pop song about how no matter what happens, she's going to get back up again and keep going. And as she's singing this, every 3 seconds, a monster eats her, or she falls into a pit full of acid, or she's struggling across, like in just this editing like this, she's struggling across a frigid landscape, a desert, and through the intestinal tract of yet another monster. And yet she keeps singing, I will get back up again. That's what 2016 felt like to me. And in the final shot of this song, this is what she looks like.
Yeah, Tyler, do we have that?
And the scene literally fades off with her singing, I will get back up again, and passing out. That, pretty much with the news of Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds, that is what I felt like.
Well
so
said.
You can find the entire thing on YouTube. It is a hoot. This is a really surreal and fun movie.
This is the first time I've wanted to watch Trolls, so thanks, Tasha.
Me too.
I have to tell you, it was a real surprise to me. It's a fun, like, candy-colored film.
Okay, so we're ready. What's your actual scene of the year?
So to set this up, it's from the movie Hidden Figures, which is based on the real life of a number of women who worked at NASA in the late 50s and early 60s. It's primarily, more than any other, the story of Katherine Johnson, who we'll see on screen, who was what they called a computer back then. She did calculations before electronic computers came into being. She's played by Taraji P. Henson. And in this sequence, she's the only black woman working in her unit. And nobody has thought about the fact that bathrooms are segregated. There is no bathroom for her in the unit. So every time she has to pee, she has to run half a mile back to the campus where all of the other black people are working, use that bathroom, and then come back. Nobody has noticed this. And the movie kind of does it over and over and plays it for laughs until the day that it rains.
Where the hell have you been? Everywhere I look, you're not where I need you to be. It's not my imagination. Now, where the hell do you go every day?
To the bathroom, sir.
To the bathroom. To the damn bathroom. For 40 minutes a day? What are you doing there? We're T-minus zero here. I put a lot of faith in you.
There's no bathroom for me here.
What do you mean there's no bathroom for you here?
There is no bathroom. There are no colored bathrooms in this building. Or any building outside the West Campus, which is half a mile away. Did you know that? I have to walk to Timbuktu just to relieve myself. And I can't use one of the handy bikes. Picture that, Mr. Harrison. My uniform, skirt below my knees, my heels, and a simple string of pearls. Well, I don't own pearls. Lord knows you don't pay coloreds enough to afford pearls. and I work like a dog, day and night, living off a coffee from a pot none of you want to touch! So, excuse me if I have to go to the restroom a few times a day.
Yeah.
Now, out of context, that plays like an Oscar clip, and it probably will be the Oscar clip we see if Henson is nominated for Best Actress. But within the context of the film, what you have is, okay, I'm going to ask you to bear with me on this one. There is a moment at the beginning of Romeo and Michelle's high school reunion.
So far, I'm all with you.
Super
I'm on board.
Yeah, stay with me. It's a circular path.
Okay,
but we get
all
back.
Right.
There's a moment where the two of them are sitting in their separate beds watching Pretty Woman, which they do apparently all the time. And they're laughing about what a stupid film it is and how much they hate it and how they've seen it 47 times. And Romy says, I love this part. They won't let her shop. Oh, so much sympathy. And a couple beats go by, and then Cheek says, I just really get so happy when they finally let her shop. And it's such a sweet moment, but it says so much about like a very simple thing that cinema often does, which is set up something a character desperately wants, come up with an unjust reason why they can't have it, and then give it to them. And it's so satisfying. When I first saw Hidden Figures, I thought, yeah, what this movie is doing is pretty simple. It's an injustice movie. It's a movie about racism. It says you can't have simple equality, and then it gives simple equality to them. Yay, everybody's happy. But this moment stuck with me so much over the course of like the next couple of months. And it's because it's shot so well, it's staged so well, with all of these blank-faced white men dressed identically. And these two women, Henson and her supervisor, played by Kirsten Dunst, dressed in actual colors. You know, they're the only people who aren't wearing identical white shirts and ties. They stand out so much because they're different from everyone else. And no one in the room has processed that until this moment. Until this moment, nobody has thought to feel empathy for her because nobody was aware of the problem. And that, for me, in an era where we seem to be having a lot of problems with empathy, just sums up 2016 so much. This feeling of, I didn't know because I wasn't listening. And once I listened to the problem, I realized that maybe we're not exactly the same and your experience is not my experience. And that might just be relevant.
Yeah.
Well, it's making politics personal, right? And I think Hidden Figures is pitched at a very different volume level than this movie I'm going to mention from 2016, Loving, from Jeff Nichols. Mm-hmm. But a similar movie in a lot of ways. And I think in that film as well, the focus is very much on the personal aspects of the interracial couple. They're fighting for justice, but they're doing it in ways that are reflected in their actual home. So it's quite personal. Here, you don't get much more personal than having to go to the bathroom and you can't, right? So by rooting this arc, this story, this larger narrative in something that means that much to her, then we can enter into it much more easily.
Yeah, you talked about satisfying. I would use that word to describe this entire film. I just caught up with it because you chose it, and it passes that 10:30 at night on a weeknight test where you're watching something that you know you're way too tired to start and you're going to crash and you're thinking about this live show that's coming up, but you got to watch this movie. And then 2 hours later, I'm perfectly content. Never once distracted, never once thought about turning it off and going to bed. I was really, really into this movie the whole time. And you talk about expression, that moment, and I'd be just fine if this is Henson's Oscar moment. And I, at this point, I'm fine with them giving it to her. That'd be great because it's that good of a performance. But it's finally that moment, unlike her other coworkers, Janelle Monáe and Octavia Spencer, they're more expressive. They're more willing to let you know how they're feeling and how dissatisfied they are. And she, up to this point, hasn't been that character. And so when it comes out with a vengeance. And it is satisfying because of that. There are a couple moments, too, that really kind of, my wife was laying next to me and I was really glad that she wasn't awake to notice me whimpering as there's a scene with Henson and Mahershala Ali, who had a great year, also a great performance in Moonlight. There's a moment between them that knocked me out. So I'm really glad you picked Hidden Figures.
Yeah, this is just, it's a terrific double let them shop moment. There's the satisfaction of what the audience wants is for her to speak out and what she wants is to get results. And both of those things happen in the same scene.
All right, so we're at my final pick, and I definitely thought about Josh's pick, the bridge dance in The Fitz. And one other I want to mention, Certain Women, Kelly Reichardt's movie, this little bit of magical realism that happens near the end of that film with Kristen Stewart and Lily Gladstone, one of the best performances of the year, and the unexpected horse ride really is kind of breathtaking in its own way. I'm going to go back and give a little bit more love, though, as well, to The Witness, the film that we've talked about a little bit. This scene is one really did strongly consider showing the whole thing and really getting into it, because it's the moment where the man you're seeing there in the shot is the son of the man who murdered Bill Genovese's sister, Kitty. And Bill has tried to talk with the man who committed the crime, who's still in jail, but he refuses. And so again, as he's trying to put these pieces together and seeking some closure, he talks to the son, and the different agendas that sort of come out, but in a very empathetic way. That's really the magic of this scene as well. You see the connection between them. You see the distance, too, when Stephen asks how Bill would feel if his father was paroled.
Because, you know, if it had not been for the notoriety of this story, he'd have probably been paroled by now.
But see, my concern is there's that part of him that seems to be a very good person, and there's that part of him that maybe has no control over that really is, for lack of a better term, a monster.
50 years ago.
50 years ago, but my concern is, where is he now?
Only thing I know is from what he told me, you know? He said he just snapped out because there was some racial tensions going on back then. And your sister was using a lot of racial slurs at him, and he just lost it. That's what he told me.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Do you realize he killed another woman?
That's something that I'm not real, sure of. I don't understand
other,
that.
And the other woman was African-American.
Okay, well, maybe he did do that. I don't know, you know?
Yeah.
That's something we never discuss.
And so you're talking to a guy who is, this whole movie is about false narratives, and he has lived his whole life dealing with the shame of this and the guilt of being the son of this man, and he talks about being taunted as a kid. And so what comes out is they both have their own ways of dealing with this story and these false narratives, but at the end of the day, they also have both been victims. And that's what's really so amazing about it. And actually, at the end of the scene, he says something to Bill about, that's why I wanted to go out and do good in the world, was after having this upbringing. And he becomes a minister. Well, this whole movie is about Bill choosing to go fight in Vietnam and try to do something with his life because of the horror of what happened to his sister. So I love that scene, but the fact is, it was too heavy. And, you know, we're trying to have fun, and we talked about how much music has been such a key part of this year and so many wonderful scenes. And did you really think I was going to get out of 2016 without talking about Sing Street?
Nope.
No, I wasn't. So, you know, this is the movie, if you haven't seen it yet, the set in Dublin in the 80s, coming-of-age drama, and the boy who, like so many boys, decides he wants to impress the older, cooler girl by forming a band, and even better, he'll check out this new thing, music videos, and cast her in his videos. And so the scene we're going to watch, I'm going with the Drive It Like You Stole It scene, the gym sequence, where he's shooting the video, and he's hoping that the girl, Rafina, will show up to play her part like she's supposed to in the scene. Let's check it out.
Okay, well, it's just kind of like 50s dancing.
Like what?
It's like dancing from the 50s, you know, clicking fingers and... Can we try some now, actually? Just... Yeah. Yeah. That's it, yeah. Yeah, maybe do a few twirls and stuff. Just do what's natural. Make it as natural as possible. Let's get some playback.
Walked out from the wreckage. Can't understand the way.
So one of the real pleasures of this film, and there are many, is watching those video sequences and hearing the songs that the character Connor writes after he's had yet another conversation with his brother, who the older brother who's turning him on to new artists. And then, curiously, the songs all seem to sound very similar to what he was just influenced by. In this case, if that bass line and the drum part sounds familiar, he's just been exposed to Hall & Oates' Maneater. And so we get Drive It Like You Stole It. But again, kind of one of the themes for tonight, this notion of art being this vehicle for expression and for dealing with your pain. He gets to live in this fantasy world when he's on stage where Ruffina looks at him exactly the way he wants her and longs for her to look at him. The priest you saw there, the school principal, who's just a terrible individual and just gives him grief throughout the entire movie, we get to see him actually being a human being for a moment and letting loose and having fun. And then, of course, those are his parents, who the movie opens with us hearing them fighting and him working on a song in his room trying to process the pain he's going through listening to his parents' marriage dissolve. And so this is that fantasy sequence where he gets to imagine them being madly in love with each other here.
It's my favorite scene from Sing Street because it does take that step into fantasy. You know, it moves a little bit into La La Land territory mm-hmm. there, but I still want to see the actual video. It just occurred to me, we don't get right. to see like the bad video with the bad dancing. Yeah. I'm hoping that's an extra on the DVD.
So this was my number one film of the year so far back in July. It ended up being my number two film in December, just behind Tower. But I think in the entire history of the show, we're approaching 12 years now, I don't think I've ever had as many people write in thanking me for a particular recommendation as has been the case with Sing Street. I'm curious, actually, how many people have seen Sing Street? Okay, so don't hurt my feelings here. How many people saw it because I kept talking about it? Okay, well, I love the fact that people saw the John Carney film.
There you go.
And I'll take that as the silver lining. But, you know, it is a film that I wanted to end 2016 on this note, and all those thank yous that we've been getting and that I've been getting for recommending it, hopefully you saw a little bit of the reason why there in that Drive It Like You Stole It sequence. We are through the show. We're done with categories.
You guys have
thank
fun?
You.
We're
thank done you with for 2016. Being so patient.
We've just written off 2016. Yep.
It's over. Can't talk about it anymore. Any thank yous?
We have a lot of thank yous. As you can imagine, there's a lot of moving parts to a show like this. So we want to thank everyone here at the Logan Center, WBEZ, of course, and WBEZ live event producer Tyler Green.
Let's give Tyler a round of applause.
Thank you so much. Mary Gaffney here as well. Golden Joe Dassault helping us out. Haley Carlson and Mary Kathleen Julian from the WBEZ events team. Anna was taking care of the stage for us. Tasha, Michael, Sam, great to have you on stage as part of the show. The WBEZ volunteers doing all sorts of work behind the scenes. Adam and I always are very grateful to our families for enjoying what we do alongside
indulging
with us and indulging what we do. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, and thank you as well to the people who submitted videos, Dave and Joanna, Joel Petrikas, Anna Rose Homer as well. We've had fun. We hope you've had fun. Go out into the night. Good night, everybody.
Have a good night.
Go watch a movie.
It's a lot of work to put together these live shows, but it really is not only so much fun to do the show in front of a live audience and a packed live audience like we had at the Logan Center, but just to think about the year in movies in this way, even though the categories may seem somewhat arbitrary, to go back and really think about the year in film in terms of the most emotional moments, the moments that made you laugh the most, and really the moments that crystallized the entire year for you in cinema, I think is valuable. I end up learning new things about these films that many of them we've already talked about in detail, but going back through them again, looking at them through that prism is instructive.
Well, it's always a pleasure at the end of the show to look back and see the variety of titles we were able mm-hmm. to get in, from the well-known Oscar contenders to the Golden Brick nominees. And I think we probably hit, I didn't do a count, but maybe 40 different films were mentioned over the course of the evening. Mm-hmm. And so many people afterwards will say what they say after every rap party: I've got a list now to work with,
yeah.
you know, of movies that were maybe sort of on my radar, but this will push me to see, or ones I hadn't heard of at all.
Yeah, I did enjoy seeing that after on social media, a lot of people pointing out that they've got a very full list of movies to see. And you mentioned the variety. I think, of course, that's really important. It would be pretty boring for all of us if we were hitting just the same two or three films, though a handful of films did come up multiple times. They were among the best films of the year. The best part is we didn't force that variety, which we might if we had to. But It turns out that just between the two of us and between our guests, we were able to get a fairly eclectic group of films in the mix.
Yeah. Tasha particularly, I think, suggested some surprising titles. Michael, of course, his usual, I think the word my dad used afterwards, sardonic self.
Of course.
I love what he brings to the live shows.
Yep.
So, yeah, altogether a great mix.
The other rewarding part is seeing some of those tweets following the show from people like Kendall, who tell us that they came from San Francisco. Unless I'm reading SF wrong, she came from San Francisco, and I'm sure she's having fun in Chicago and doing some other things, but she came here mainly to see the live show.
That's incredible.
I mean, I hope we made it worth her time. There were, of course, other people who traveled some long distances, and it, of course, makes us feel very good. I know there were a couple people afterwards, too, that wanted to hang out and talk to us a little bit. We did meet some in the lobby, both before and after the show, but there were a few others. I said, we'll be there, and then we missed them later. So, you know, hopefully you can come to another live show at some point. We are always eager to talk to our listeners.
A couple of film spotting meetups are in the works. You're going to be in LA soon. I'm going to be at Sundance. We'll have information about both of those on the forum at filmspotting.net. So maybe not huge opportunities for everyone to come and get together, but the people who are going to be in those places coming up in this next month will try to get out there and catch up with you.
Yeah, in fact, we will put a link directly to that forum post with information about those meetups in the show notes for this episode at filmspotting.net.
We want to hear your comments about this live show. Go ahead and send them to feedback@filmspotting.net. Is there an under-the-radar 2017 film that you are looking forward to? Leave us a voicemail with that, 312-264-0744, and we might just include it on our 2017 preview show, which is coming up. You can find that number for voicemails under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We're also on Facebook, of course, and on Twitter. On Twitter, Adam's at filmspotting. I'm at Larson on film.
Also at filmspotting.net is where you can find over 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. While you're there, vote in the current film spotting poll. We haven't had a chance to really set this poll up yet, Josh, but it is previewing that 2017 preview that's ahead. And it's the death match of 2017 that Sam, our wonderful producer, and I came up with. And I really think it's a pretty good one. We went through some different variations. You could combine some sci-fi movies, some superhero movies, but the two films that I felt our listeners would have the hardest time picking between, you tell me if I'm wrong, are these Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk versus Blade Runner 2049, directed by Denis Villeneuve.
That's tough.
It is tough.
Instinctual response, Dunkirk.
Me too.
You got to go with the original vision, not the reheat.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. We'll see if our listeners are with us. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. If you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Out in wide release this weekend, The Founder, starring Michael Keaton as Ray Kroc. Split, the latest from M. Night Shyamalan with James McAvoy as a man suffering from multiple personality disorder. And I know the one you just can't wait to see. You're going to be sure to get to the theater before you head off to Sundance, Josh. XXX3, Return of Xander Cage.
That sounds like algebra.
It does, actually, doesn't it? Out in limited release, 20th Century Women, that's expanding wide. Julieta, the latest from Pedro Almodovar, which you like.
Very good. Yeah, not getting enough attention, but especially for those of you who appreciate his Hitchcockian films, this is along those lines.
King Cobra, a movie about the gay porn industry, circa 2006, with James Franco, Christian Slater, Alicia Silverstone, and Molly Ringwald, and our friend David Ehrlich calls it a sensitive and darkly hilarious true crime story that works from top to bottom. He's got me interested. Patterson, directed by Jim Jarmusch, reviewed favorably on episode 618. Also out in limited release here in Chicago, Peter and the Farm, highly recommended by Scott Tobias during our Top 10 Films of the Year show, and Things to Come. This is in the top two or three movies I most regret not seeing before our Top 10 show and before the wrap party, starring Isabelle Huppert, directed by Mia Hansen Love, and Tony Erdmann, much praised by everyone on our Top 10 of 2016 show, and did get featured during the wrap party as well. Also, finally, available to Chicago theater goers.
Huge week for Chicago releases.
It is.
These
lower level, not blockbuster releases. So get out there, see one of these.
I would love to see Tony Erdmann versus Xander Cage. I mean, can we make that happen?
No, I don't think that's going to happen.
Next week on the show, Goodbye 2016, Hello 2017. It will be part one of our 2017 movie preview. I'm not sure who my guest host is going to be yet because, Josh, you will be gallivanting around Park City at Sundance.
And I'll try to call in.
Yes,
can we try to work that
plan
out? Maybe from the meetup. I don't know. We'll
that
see.
That would be interesting.
I know you.
Between
you're,
sips of whatever you're drinking.
You're persnickety about audio quality.
I am.
And it probably wouldn't live up to those standards, but might be fun.
It might be fun. So we're going to plan on that. Hopefully call in, tell us about what you've seen out there at Sundance. And in addition to the preview, the most anticipated films of the year, we might just review Split. I want to see Split, the latest from
Shyamalan.
Yeah, it
does look intriguing.
And that very well could be the movie that gets our main review next week.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.